at some point, enough is enough. And I mean, it's always nice to have more, but I've got enough, thankfully. Another two or three or whatever, or four, whatever, would not change my life at all. Because I can do anything I want to do, anything that I'm going to want to do right now.
Hey, everybody. I'm Sam Coates, and this is the Driven By Podcast. Life's a lot more fun when you're all in and passionate about what you're building. Here, you'll hear me with entrepreneurs, operators, executives, and public servants from all over the country. They'll discuss their commitment to their craft, defining moments, what's made them successful, where things are headed in their space, plus so much more. This podcast is produced by the team at drivenbysamcoates.com. And for more information and episodes, go to drivenbysamcoates.com/podcasts. Before we get to today's episode, here's a quick word from our sponsor for today's podcast. AB Jets is a great story. It started very small with an entrepreneur and a dream, and it's now one of the largest Lear 60 jet companies in the United States. AB Jets has received the prestigious Argus Platinum rating the last 8 consecutive years, which goes to less than 5% of operators in the world. So bypass the hassle and fly private. Go to abjets.com for more information or call them at 888-520-JETS. Hey, everybody. My guest this week is Chris Mercer. 42 years ago, Chris left the investment bank Morgan Keegan and launched Mercer Capital. Mercer Capital provides business valuation and financial advisory services to clients worldwide. To date, Chris says they've served over 15,000 companies. Today, Mercer Capital has 57 associates in 4 offices throughout the country. With the documentaries and interviews my team and I produce, I spend a lot of time with entrepreneurs and companies across the country. Businesses and entrepreneurs fascinate me. The risk, the hardship, the passion, the growth, perfecting one's craft, and so much more. What better person to have a conversation with than someone who has examined the inner workings of thousands of companies over the last 4 decades? But also someone who has done much more than just advising. Someone who's an entrepreneur in their own right and founded something that will pass on to the next generation. Please enjoy this episode with Chris Mercer. Chris, thanks for doing this. Great to see you.
It's great to see you too.
What's the future of private businesses look like in the United States from where we are today here, 2024?
Well, I think that the future for private business is pretty good, actually. I think, you know, there's a great deal of consolidation. Bigger companies are acquiring smaller companies, but smaller companies are being created all the time. And there are just niches that small companies will always fill. So I'm thinking, based on looking at our business and looking at our clients' businesses, that folks are fairly optimistic about the future.
Could you explain maybe what that looks like to you with consolidation, but with there still being gaps and niches that are going to be just open with opportunity?
Consolidation, I think, has been accelerated by a lack of planning on the part of many business owners. It's a fact of life that ownership will transition in every business. And if an owner is not prepared for that transition, then there may well be a temptation or a need to sell when it otherwise wouldn't have had to happen. So I'm thinking that business owners need to be planning for management of transition and ownership transition. And those things, if they're done properly, will forestall the need for a lot of sales, at least for another generation or two.
Before we started recording, you shared how Mercer Capital today is an ESOP, but it didn't start that way. From your own experience, how far out do you advise someone that they need to be thinking about planning for succession in the next generation?
A number of years ago, many years ago, really, I had what I call the rule of 55. And that is that by the time a business owner gets to be 55, there ought to be a compelling reason for owning a controlling interest in a private business. In other words, if ownership should be transitioned either to the next generation or something, bad things happen to good people, and no one wants to have their estate taxed based upon a controlling interest in a private business. So I have advised people for years to move down below that threshold. So I call that the rule of 55.
Could you back up a little bit? How did Mercer Capital start?
I was the bank stock analyst at a company called Morgan Keegan & Company, which was a Memphis-based investment banking firm. They're now part of Raymond James. But I joined Morgan Keegan in late 1978. I was the bank stock analyst there, quite a number of regional banks, and wrote about the regional banks and traveled with salesmen to talk about regional banks. And so I had a decent banking background. I had been assistant treasurer at First Tennessee prior to that. When we began to do some investment banking at Morgan Keegan, I was involved with that. And essentially, because we were such a small firm, when an appraisal opportunity came in, I told Mr. Morgan that I would just take care of it. And he said, you know, if you take care of it, we'll take care of you. And I said, that's fine. So I started valuing businesses at Morgan Keegan in 1979. By 1982, I was 34 years old. My wife and I had saved up enough money that I didn't have to have a paycheck for a while if I were unfortunate in making a move. But in June of 1982, I started Mercer Capital Management, Inc. And I called it that because I didn't know exactly what we would be doing, except starting as a valuation-related firm. We got started in 1982, realized fairly quickly that I needed some help, brought a college professor on to join me to give me a little intellectual capability. And then I brought on a guy who had worked at Union Planners in the bank consulting subsidiary. And so we ended up kind of a half and half valuation and bank consulting. We did that for a few short years. But I decided that the consulting business was good for somebody else, and that what I wanted to do was to build a valuation firm that would be regional at first and then national. And that was the idea that I had beginning in about 1985. So by 1987, we were out of the bank consulting business and were indeed a valuation-related and financial advisory firm.
What'd you love, or what sparked your interest about doing valuations?
I've always been interested in corporate finance and the finance side of things. Valuation is there's an element of art and there's an element of science, but there's an element that is fascinating to me to try to discern the value of companies in a manner in which people have enough confidence in what you've done that they'll actually spend hard dollars investing based on it. So anyway, it's always just been an interest for me. I've been moving toward that direction for a long time.
What does trust mean to you, your work and your clients, and the things that people risk to do what you value something at?
In the appraisal business, trust is very important. People have to know that when they do business with us, that we're not going to convey their secrets to the rest of the world. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that people like to do business with people that they know and that they like and that they trust. And we want them to know us. We want our clients to like us, and we want them to trust us. Because if we do those things, we're building good client relationships that will last for decades. And we have several multi-decade clients.
What do you think made that trust stay there for multiple decades?
I told my kids a long time ago, do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. Do it on time. You know, do what. And that's what we've always tried to do, is to deliver. Quality is overstated, I think, in many service businesses, but to deliver a high quality product, one that people can understand and that makes sense, and to deliver it on time in a manner the customer is satisfied.
couple things there I think we'll come back to, but I've been with a few folks now that started or spent a good portion of their time with Morgan Keegan. And I did not know that was in your background as well. What can you share about your time there?
Well, I had been assistant treasurer at First Tennessee, and so I was interested in finance. I had a flickering moment with what was called KPMG, Pete Marvin Mitchell & Co., down in Houston. But then I came back to Morgan Keegan as the bank analyst. What I learned at Morgan Keegan, my goodness, I was a pretty good analyst, but I honed those skills to a great extent. I was a fairly decent communicator, but I had to communicate with the sales force on a weekly basis about what I was thinking and what I was doing. And so my communication skills were improved a great deal. I worked with some of the best salespeople at Morgan Keegan, and I learned a good bit about what I would call subtle selling. And I disregarded what I learned about not so subtle selling. But I learned that I would have to be able to sell if I wanted to achieve what I wanted to achieve in life. So those communication, honing analytical skills, picking up a specialty, and then learning to sell.
And what do you think made Morgan Keegan such a unique place to sell?
They just had wonderful leadership. Alan Morgan was as fine a man, fine a businessman as walked. I mean, he was just a great man to work for. I worked for his father well down below at First Tennessee, but Alan Morgan was just a gentleman and, in my experience, fair with everyone. And the other leaders in the firm, there had a number of shareholders. Everybody got along. There was if there was tension, I didn't feel it, because we were focused on making money for Morgan Keegan. Because if the company did well, then everybody did well. It was a great atmosphere to work and learn.
How many partners and associates do you have today in the four offices of Mercer Capital?
We now have 57. Folks under the Mercer Capital banner.
And that's in Houston, Dallas, Memphis, Tennessee, and Nashville, Tennessee, correct?
That is correct.
What can you say about the characteristics and qualities that you look for in the people, or your successor looks for in the people at Mercer, that still fit the mold from a trust standpoint?
We have always wanted to find, hire, and retain smart people who are good analysts, who can write. And if someone is smart, is a decent analyst, and can write, then they can learn the valuation business. What we've always tried to do is to have a workplace where people would want to stay. We always like it when we bring young men into Memphis in years past, and they marry Memphis girls, because the prospects of retention are increased significantly, or vice versa. You know, our goal has always been to go to good schools, hire good people, and then train them and retain them so that we can gain from, and we can benefit, and they can benefit from their experience. Our retention over the years has been very good. My first employee, Barbara Walters Price, is now our chief marketing officer and a member of the board of directors, and has been at Mercer Capital 40 years plus some, going into the 41st year. Matt Crow, our current president, he's been president since 2009, has been with us 29 or 30 years. Our goal is to make it a nice place to work, a good place to work, that is, shall I say, benefits rich and profit sharing oriented. And those characteristics, I think, have helped us retain people over the years.
AB Jets is a great story. It started very small with an entrepreneur and a dream, and it's now one of the largest Lear 60 jet companies in the United States. AB Jets has received the prestigious Argus Platinum rating the last 8 consecutive years, which goes to less than 5% of operators in the world. So bypass the hassle and fly private. Go to abjets.com for more information, or call them at 888-520-JETS. What have you learned about balancing professionalism, excellence, entrepreneurial spirit, but then also trying to be a good place to work? How could you teach that, or how do you teach that to other entrepreneurs or CEOs or presidents that are trying to figure that out while also trying to not be mediocre?
Well, mediocre is not acceptable at Mercer County. It's just not an acceptable characteristic. So I guess the balance is I've always tried to lead in terms of those kinds of things by example. And I've been out front and the public face of Mercer Capital, or I have been. I'm much less so today because, like I say, Matt Crowe has been running the place since 2009. Ownership transition is complete. So what we have to do is we have to hire, train, and retain good people. And if we do those kinds of things and set the right example by our senior people, our people learn the process of selling by observation and by participation. They learn the process of client relationship by participation and observation. And frankly, since COVID, since we're all now on Zoom, that process has been accelerated for our young people because where it might not be feasible to put two people on a plane or three people on a plane, we can always put two or three people in a room to interview the senior people at a company. And that is a wonderful experience for a 25-year-old or a 22-year-old. And they see how our senior people react and respond, and they learn through that process. And then we have an internal training program at Mercer Capital that we shoot for like 40 hours of training per year, where we train ourselves and occasionally bring someone else in to provide a presentation for us. This gives our young people opportunities to burrow down on a topic and give a good presentation. It gives us all an opportunity to learn in our training program. So Wednesday at 11 o'clock, that's where I'm going to be if I possibly can.
What are your opinions about Zoom, about the future, and where things are a couple of years after COVID, and what's going to stay and what's going to go back, revert back?
I think that Zoom and Teams, you know, all of these platforms have, in essence, changed the manner in which our business, for example, is done. We couldn't visit people during COVID for, you know, 18 months or so, or maybe longer. No one wanted us. We didn't want to go. And so I had been on Zoom for maybe two meetings prior to March 15th, 2020. I was in New York testifying at an arbitration. We met Monday. We met Tuesday. I testified on direct on Tuesday. And then two of the arbitrators were from Westchester County in New York. And they said, we're not coming back. This thing is getting out of hand. And so everybody went home or wherever they went on Wednesday and Thursday. I testified I was cross-examined on Zoom for the first time ever. Now, that's happened a number of times since. So it has changed the necessity, the absolute necessity of visiting companies. But what it really does is it provides when we, for example, a longtime client, we're meeting in Washington, D.C. week after next. We have had meetings on Zoom, okay? But we meet at least every other year in person because we all want to maintain that relationship. And we can provide better service to them. And they realize that we can provide better service to them if we know them. So I think it's a combination that will enhance the way it has enhanced the way we do business.
How hard has it been to build Mercer Capital, given some of the players that are your competition with national and global brands?
I never really thought about it being hard to build Mercer Capital. I never worried about all of those national players or all of those other people, because I figured out early on that if we did what we were supposed to do, we were sufficiently outbound, we did a good quality job delivered on time, that our reputation would build and our business would grow. I've said many times, most of the time, we're not competing with somebody else for a job. I mean, over it used to be a little more frequently where we'd be cross proposals, but more frequently now people find us because we're active in a niche where they're in. They find us on the internet. They find us through the old fashioned referrals. They find us through writing. They find us through speaking. Our people are out there speaking actively around the country in meetings of business owners, lawyers, accountants, and other appraisers. So all of those things, when you put them together and you keep doing them consistently over a long period of time, provide, I think, the juice necessary to grow. And then you got to go back and make sure you hire good people, you retain them, you train them, and you let them grow.
Is it also fair to say that you filled a void when you first started in a city that needed someone or a team like yours?
Well, I'd like to think that's true, Sam, but it didn't work that way. When I opened Mercer Capital, it seemed like, I don't know if people thought I was looking for a job or what, but no one in Memphis, almost no one in Memphis, did business with me early on. So I did the next best thing. I said, where are there people? Well, there are people in Nashville. So I went to Nashville and started developing business. There are people in Jackson, Mississippi. So I went to Jackson, Mississippi to develop business. There are people in Birmingham. There are people in Little Rock. There are people in St. Louis. There are people in Louisville. And so early on, we began to travel and do business development, trying to build relationships, and then to build an outbound information program, the newsletters that you've seen on our website and that sort of thing, where once we are in touch with someone, we have the ability to stay in touch with those people. We've been building our database for all these years.
So you left your job at Morgan Keegan, which I'm sure you could have written that for a long time.
A lot of my friends did.
Yes, sir. And you hang your shingle here in Memphis and you weren't getting any business in the city that you opened it. You had to go out to these other markets.
Well, let me be direct. I did not go out into business desiring to fail. I knew I had three people that would retain my services as a financial advisor on a limited basis. And that would keep me going, you know, for a long enough while to try to build things. And so I worked for two local companies and a company down in Jackson, Mississippi, as a part-time CFO, or as a board member for the company down in Jackson, as a board member for another private company in Memphis, but where they used me actively as a consultant. So that sort of made sure that I had a little bit of cash coming in. And then I was determined that we were going to develop the valuation business. So I went where I had to go to get it. Now, we do a lot of business in Memphis now.
You were talking about Jackson, Nashville, Louisville, St. Louis. When you think about your career and decades of experience, you talked about building relationships and outbound information and how you can nurture that time and it just compounds. When you think about clients and prospects, what does the relationship look like?
That's an interesting question. One never knows how a relationship starts. It might be a referral. It might be a visit. It might be someone finds us on the web and calls in. It finds out who they talk to. But what we're going to be trying to do is, if a client calls me and wants to talk about a project, one of my first jobs is to get someone with me to build a team so that the client has a team to work with and not just an individual person. We want our clients to know that they can call Mercer Capital and it's okay. Doesn't matter who they talk to. We tried to build our system in a fashion that works. So I think that the whole process, I think the relationship building begins with, let's call it, responsiveness. I've discovered that it's hard to get a proposal from a lot of appraisal firms. People will tell me that they didn't get a proposal. Well, if you give me the information, or any of our people, the information that we need to develop a proposal. Our system is geared that that proposal is going to go out that day or the next day at the latest. And so what I've said to more than one person over the years, many people over the years, when we were competing for business, he said, well, I haven't gotten the other proposal yet. And I said, well, you ought to consider the service that you're not getting from them relative to the service you've already gotten from us when you make your decision.
Are you surprised where things are today? Or did you see this?
Well, if I were to go back to 1982, I'd be surprised. But I've been here 42 years. And so we've had a lot of surprises along the way, but it's been a building and a growing process. And so it's not a surprise. What I'm really pleased about is that our people have been able to work together, to stay together, and to grow together. And we've grown as a firm. I mentioned before that we started that Mercer Capital has an employee stock ownership plan. That was part of my ownership transition planning back in 2006. Well, today, the ESOP owns 90% of the stock of Mercer Capital. And fortunately, they allowed me to retain 10%. So that works well. But we have a profit sharing plan. We have 401k, and we encourage everyone to participate to the max in the 401k. And then we have the employee stock ownership plan. And we've been a profitable company. So if we make a dollar after all expenses and bonuses, then the ESOP's going to get 90 cents of that dollar after state tax. And they don't pay tax. I get 10% after state taxes, and I pay tax. But that's the way of the world. I'm happy to pay the tax. But the fact of the matter is, we considered selling. We have been approached by a number of folks over the years who were interested in acquiring Mercer Capital. But most recently, at the beginning of COVID, and I basically sat down with our senior folks and I said, we're not going to get comfortable when we can't travel and they can't travel. So let's just articulate a plan to finish this ownership transition. And we did. We've all met our responsibilities under that. And I couldn't be happier with where we are. This is interesting. I was on a podcast recently, and the host was just convinced that every seller had seller's remorse. And I said, well, no, I don't have seller's remorse. I'm happy where I am. I'm happy with where the company is. I'm happy that they have their destiny in their own hands and they can continue to grow and to make money and build retirements. And that to me is a pretty good legacy, better than selling to a big bank.
Your organization that you founded and now have 10% of today, how many different transactions and valuations do you review a year collectively?
Collectively, we have probably 600 or 700 clients per year that we do business with. Many of those are repeat clients and many of those are new clients. And that number gradually rises.
So take that number and multiply that times 42 years. And I know it's not true at the beginning that many, but what can you say about all the things that you've seen for the entrepreneurs that structure something where their own associates and teammates are going to get a piece of the pie at some point versus people that choose to maintain majority control the entire time?
In 1987, the college professor that I told you that I had brought on, and I had a parting of the ways. That's when we were getting out of the bank consulting business. And what I told the staff then, maybe 7 or 8 people, this company is a profit sharing company. And if we make it, we're gonna count money like count dollars like this. I'm gonna calculate pre-tax and pre-bonus profitability. And then whatever that number is, 30% of that will go to the bonus pool. And then very, very shortly thereafter, we put in a profit sharing plan and the 401k plan and made a profit sharing contribution, made cash bonuses. And so everyone, in a sense, had a piece of the pie from the beginning. We talked about selling internally, but I ended up not doing that because I had seen it not work in a number of companies where my friends were. I mean, it just didn't work. So what we've always done is we've had a clear demarcation between reward on labor and reward on ownership. And so in 06, 1-1-06, we put in the ESOP. They bought about just shy of 50% of the company. And that was paid off in less than 8 years. The ESOP is shared 50% of profitability of the company until the last few years when they moved up to 90%. And so if you think about, if it is a profitable company and it makes a fair amount of money and 90% goes into the ESOP that is tax deferred, that is, I think, retirement planning on steroids for our folks. Many of them will be better off than they would have been had they bought 5% of the company, you know, something like that.
Can you speak to the quality of people that you have that you've been able to retain and the success to the client? Do you think that's tied to the way you've orchestrated it?
Well, I've never given a thought to I should have done something differently. I should have done. I don't look back. If I feel that way, then I'm going to do something maybe differently going forward. But, you know, you talk about quality of our people. The quality of our senior people is phenomenal. Many of them have national reputations in their own right at this point. And we've created a platform where they find it advantageous to build their careers in the context of Mercer Capital, as opposed to going somewhere else. If my profit sharing and ESOP contribution is 25% of pay, I mean, someone might offer a higher salary, but it's hard to match the total package. We've retained excellent people, and they've done well.
What's the future of service businesses in the economy that we're in today and the way things will continue to be with technology, AI, and how fast things are moving?
Well, let me pass on AI for just a moment. I think that the future for professional services is seen on our website and on the websites of other companies who have figured out that you can't do everything for everybody. And if that's your strategy, your marketing will never be successful. We have a number of niches at Mercer Capital. Our first was banks. We have insurance companies. We have asset managers. We have trucking companies. We have construction companies. We have wholesale beer distributorships. I mean, these are people, we have people who have valued many of these, auto dealerships and on and on. Fintech companies. One of our guys wrote a book on fintech, and he's developed a very good, very good business with financial technology companies. But most of the people that are senior have developed a niche or other. We have a couple of generalists, and they do very well. But the newer people are specialized. And I think one of the things that I speak about sometimes is the future of business appraisal at some of the appraisal conferences. And one of the things that I've said is that if you don't have some kind of specialization, it doesn't mean that 100% of your business is going to be there, but you've got to have some way to articulate your skills, your abilities, and your capabilities to clients. And it's almost impossible to do if you don't have some kind of specialization. The interesting thing is that when I had a specialization in banks, that crossed over and gave people, a number of people, comfort that we would do well with their companies. I mean, I had some experience with companies, but it was the bank business that got the initial exposure. And because I had that exposure, I was able to develop the next niche. And I've been a serial nicher, if that's the word.
So you're not hiring people like yourself?
We wouldn't be a very good company if all of us were like me. I've had a set of skills and a certain persistence to keep on keeping on, but I'm not a good manager. And I have a hard time managing myself, you know, much less 57 people. But Matt Groh and Travis Arms, our CEO and president, and our chief admin officer and a chief marketing officer do a marvelous job. And, you know, they talk to each other, they work on things, and they make things happen that I never could have made happen. I mean, it just wouldn't have happened. So it's a good thing that I didn't hire a bunch of these. We wouldn't have succeeded.
I can't help but notice businesses that started after World War II and people that served and came back and just had an idea, worked very hard and started something that has just created tremendous value for the people they hired, but also their families and generations after. Is there anything that you can share about entrepreneurship, work ethic, risk, tenacity that maybe exists more after a global conflict where there's a tremendous amount of sacrifice and suffering versus where we are today, where other than the conflict in the Middle East over the last 20 years, where it hasn't pulled as many people in? Is there anything that you can see where those things that can drive entrepreneurship?
I think that there will always be people who are going to step up and start something. I think one thing you mentioned just a moment ago triggered a thought that I thought I would share with you. And that is, if you're in business and if you're doing things and if you see the ability to do something, do it. In other words, just go ahead and do it. Because my biggest problem over the years has been a lack of ability just to pursue certain opportunities that came along. Maybe I thought it was too risky or whatever, but it was not that. It was just that I didn't do it. And that's the only thing in retrospect that I think I would do differently. And I've been asked that question. And that is that there were a couple of opportunities, you know, back in the 90s with the banks where we could have raised money and invested in banks and taken off into an asset management capability. And I just let time pass. I let the opportunity pass. So my suggestion is, if you've got that idea and you've got the capability and it's a manageable risk, just do it.
What about from a regulation standpoint? How do you see that affecting private business, public business, entrepreneurship today? And what will that look like in the future?
That's a borderline political question, because I think that the current, I've used the term not perversely, but the current regime is all about regulation. I think that excessive regulation is harmful for business. I think that government cannot know better how to run businesses than the business owners that do it and take care of clients. So I've been involved with banks all of my adult life, and there's no group of people, no group of companies that are as heavily regulated as banks. And I will tell you that it's stifling. It's stifling. I would hope that would there would be less regulation or more thoughtful regulation in the future than just regulating for regulating's sake.
You think there's any chance for improvement?
Well, I think, the fact of the matter is, I think things will improve because people will figure out how to do business. I mean, if we've got to do something a little differently because of a regulation, we'll figure out how to do it a little differently. And we'll get around it, or they'll change the regulation. You know, I mean, I'm pretty optimistic about the future.
You're optimistic about the future of markets, future of business, and you're optimistic about the future of that here in the United States.
Yes, I am. So, as they say, my money is not where my mouth is.
What makes you optimistic?
Well, I've always been a pretty optimistic person. I have a favorable outlook on life. I enjoy life. I enjoy what I do. And if you have those characteristics, then it's pretty easy to be optimistic. What I have seen is that pessimism is the death knell of accomplishing anything. I mean, I've never been pessimistic. I just haven't been sufficiently optimistic. And that was the criticism of myself that I was making earlier. But never have I been pessimistic. In 2001, when the former President Bush signed the estate tax repeal, more than 50% of 50% of our business went away just like that. The gift and estate tax business. And, you know, some of the people around me were panicking. And I just said, No, 50% of 50%, that's 25%. Our margin is at least that. So we'll survive, you know, if nothing else happens. But we put ourselves into a couple of new businesses. The goodwill impairment testing business was a regulatory change that had come into play at about this time. And so we wrote a little book called Valuation for Impairment Testing, a little green book. And we were talking about advertising. I said, well, who do we want to have this book? We said, we want CFOs and we want partners in accounting firms that do audits. And so I said, well, can we identify those? And they said, well, yeah, we can. They were talking about spending $50,000 or something advertising in Inc. magazine and that sort of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I mean, I just said, well, how much would it cost to put one book by Federal Express on those 2,500 desks that you want? And they said, it would be about $15,000 or something like that. Well, we did that in about 75 days, and we were in a new business. That year, at the end of I give a little talk at Christmas each year, and I said, the bad news is that our earnings are down 15% from last year. The good news is that our earnings are only down 15% from last year. But everybody got a bonus, and we moved on.
What you're saying is you can adapt.
You have to. You absolutely have to.
What can you say about, of all the people you've been with, the people you've served, what have you most learned about people that you know today that you may not have known 30 years ago?
I have learned to have faith in the people that we do business with. I don't know if that's answering your question or not, but if we have a good relationship and they have a good relationship coming back, I have learned that that is a prescription for long-lasting business. I didn't necessarily have that long-term view when I was working on my fourth, fifth, 10th, or 100th client. But, you know, we've done business with over 15,000 companies since inception. And we just have to have faith that if we do what we're supposed to do, they'll do what they're supposed to do. I have learned that most of the time, that is the right attitude to have. There may be a rare exception, but most of the time, that is the right attitude.
What can you share about family generational businesses? 30% make it to the second, 12% make it to the third, at least from what I've seen, and 3 or 4% make it to the fourth. I guess, first off, do you agree with that data?
Well, I don't have conflicting data. I've heard similar statistics, you know, for many years. They overstate the case to some extent, because one of the reasons that some companies don't make it to the second generation is they just didn't make it. And if you count all of those companies in the sample, then that proportion that doesn't make it is going to be huge. Okay. But of the companies that succeeded for 5 years, you know, some make it and some don't. But that is really a function of the ability and the willingness of the founder, the founders, to convey ownership transition, ownership, you know, transitioning and management transitioning in a timely way. Because if dad runs the company until he's 72, and I'll give you an example. A number of years, many years ago, I was appraising a company. The chairman of the company was in his 80s. He had a chauffeur take him to the office with his breathing machine, and he would spend 2 hours or 2.5 hours at the office each business day. And he made every business decision. His son was the president of the company, was 65 years old. Well, the guy died. The son committed suicide, and the company was out of business within a short period of time. If that's the attitude that a founder has, then the probability is very low. For those who are willing to share and willing to put ownership, if they want ownership in the family, to keep ownership in some semblance of order in the family, and then create the vehicle for the other people not in the family who must be there in order for the company to continue to succeed, then they'll continue, they will succeed. I mean, there's nothing magic about moving into the second generation if you're bringing all of your people with you. Where people fail is when they didn't do anything and they had no option but to sell. I have some friends that had a sizable valuation firm, and they were a couple of years younger than me, but they had no successor management, and they ended up selling to a bank, and now things have just kind of frittered away. I'm very happy that Mercer Capital is still here, independent, and 90% owned, 100% owned by employees.
So you're saying at times greed can play a very strong part into this?
And quite often, it's not necessarily greed, okay? It may well be just an inability to let go. It's not so much greed as complacency. It's really easy for a business owner who is 60 years old to think, I'm going to last forever. And, you know, you go to 65, you think, well, I'm going to last forever. Well, you know, you get to my age, you know you're not going to last forever. So I'm going to play pickleball as much as I can and stay in pretty good shape. And then I'm going to let Matt and Travis and Barbara and Lisa and the rest of the team run. I say let them. I mean, they are running. And they do such a great job. I can't be complimentary enough.
What's kept you locked in for 42 years?
There were a couple of times early on when I thought maybe an opportunity would create itself. For example, as a bank analyst in New York. I had a couple of opportunities to go up there, and I just didn't want to live in New York. I wanted to live where I was living and raise my kids where I was raising my kids. So once I started the path at Mercer Capital, I really never gave a great deal of thought to doing anything else other than trying to grow it. I mean, it's been a good place for me for 42 years. And it's provided the ability for me to retire, and it's providing the ability for other people to retire with. And so I think I've really never given the thought of jumping ship, so to speak.
Yes, sir.
At some point, I couldn't afford to, because we've been building value. So, you know, I'm not going to leave that value behind.
Of all the people you've met, the companies you've seen, what are the most important characteristics that you think somebody needs to have if they're going to be a high-performing entrepreneur?
Oh, my goodness, Sam. I've got five people in the back of my mind right now. And what I can tell you is that other than perhaps persistence and strong will, they had nothing else in common. I mean, I don't think there's any magic formula for entrepreneurial success. It takes a certain amount of vision. You got to be able to see that there's a future there, and then you got to be able to do something to work toward it. But people do that in so many different ways. It's unbelievable. One client, we've been doing business with them since 1988, 89. Gifts have been made from the first generation to the second generation, to the third, and now to the fourth generation. Unfortunately, Dad stayed on and ran things until he couldn't run things, and the children never got a chance to run things. But the good news is that they had some good advisors, and they had some very good people, and they skipped a generation with the sons, and now has competent, you know, management. So that company will do well, but that's not the way it might ought to be done. But he never had sufficient confidence in himself or in his sons to pick one to run.
You've been in this business 42 years. Could you maybe help listeners, including myself, imagine and see what will markets, what will business, what will entrepreneurship, what will it look like 25 years from now?
I can look back 25 years And, you know, the business environment has been evolving and businesses have been growing. If I project that forward 25 years, I would be fairly optimistic that many businesses will continue to do well and to adapt to the environment as it exists when they get there or as they're getting there. But I'm maybe falsely, but I'm not a pessimist, but I'm very optimistic about the future of business. And that's a good thing to be, because we see a lot of businesses. I mean, we're doing business with 700 maybe clients a year. That's exposure to a lot of businesses. Many of them are doing very, very well.
What do you see for Mercer in the future?
Mercer Capital started in Memphis. I did a program with another appraiser, well-known nationally, Jay Fishman. He started out in Philadelphia. We did this program. I started out in Memphis. So I drew a circle where there were 5 million people around Memphis. And then I drew a little tiny circle where there were 5 million people around Jay, where he started. And so the point was that we had to have a different strategy than he did in order to build our business. And we built our business from Memphis consciously to build probably maybe the largest single office business appraisers in the country. If not, we're very close to it. That strategy won't work for the next 10, 15, or 20 years. So our strategy now is we have a nice office in Dallas and a nice office in Houston, and we're consciously trying to grow there. I mean, because that's where the people are and that's where the businesses are. 35% of our business last year was in Texas. So, I mean, that's a big change. We acquired a small company. They joined us about 8 or 9 years ago, and they have grown along with the Houston office to become a significant portion of the firm. So I'm thinking that Matt's strategy is going to be, we're going to develop there, and then we're going to look at opportunities as they arise elsewhere. But I don't think you'll see us on the West Coast. In 1990, I had an office in Tampa, Florida, and in Los Angeles. And they didn't embrace our marketing. And I realized that we were not ready to manage that far-flung operation. So we dissolved all of that. But I think you'll see Mercer Capital growing in population centers in the Southeast, and making a conscious effort to do so. I think you'll probably see us developing another niche or two. We're light in healthcare, and I think healthcare is so big that we just have to be in the business in order to get some. So I think you're going to see additional niches, and you'll see a geographical focus, and continuing to try to do quality work and to hire, train, retain quality people. And that's the strategy.
What value has been added to your life by you having the courage and confidence to share your ideas and your knowledge?
It's benefited me enormously. It's benefited me in terms of personal confidence, if you will, and it's benefited me financially because we've built a successful business. But I decided early on that the key to growing out of Memphis, Tennessee, was that I had to be actively writing and speaking. And so an attorney friend of mine said, wherever two or three are gathered, Chris will give a speech. So I started writing and I started speaking. And that writing led me to a certain amount of notoriety in the appraisal profession early on, and a certain amount of national exposure that made me attractive to speak not only to appraisers, but to accountants and to attorneys and to financial planners and other people who can refer business to us. So my willingness to go out and do that has helped Mercer Capital enormously, and the willingness of others at Mercer Capital to continue to do that is helping Mercer Capital enormously. We started a quarterly newsletter in the first quarter of 1988. We called it Value Added. We now have numerous newsletters. We have many white papers. We're just out there. I learned that it's far better to share your knowledge about valuation, because by sharing, other people appreciate you, and a significant amount of business that comes to me comes from other appraisers, because they don't have the capability to do it, and so they call me because they know me. And they've known me for a long time. So it's been an enormous benefit. I mean, personally, and of course, as we've grown financially.
Could you clarify what you meant when you were talking about your friend, your colleague in Philadelphia, and then you were talking about yourself in Memphis, and you circled it around the map, and you said 5 million people, something like that. But you said that's not going to work anymore. What do you mean by that?
Well, we can't grow the kind of firm we want to grow from Memphis alone. We have to be closer to population centers.
So you've identified the markets in the United States, like the Southeast or like Texas, like you said, that you feel or your team feels has a lot of opportunity and upside.
We're there, and we've been building there for a number of years, and it makes a lot of sense to continue to do that. I mentioned the population surrounding Memphis, the population surrounding Dallas and Houston, that's 20 million people, 25 million people, and heavily business oriented. So we're going to focus there for sure.
What's it feel like at this stage of your career and life to think about the decisions that you made with partners to create an ESOP, to create opportunity for people connected to you, and think about the impact of their own lives personally?
I am grateful that we installed the ESOP when we did. It has created a significant retirement benefit for our people. We have a number of people who are much younger than me who have the ability to retire already from the combination of their personal savings and the 401k. Profit sharing contributions and the ESOP. So I guess that is the result of thinking and planning and struggling about what to do. But I am most pleased and most happy about that series of decisions that led there, because I couldn't have a better legacy if I would have a much worse legacy if we sold. Okay. Because they can, if and when they want to sell, they control the company. But right now, I think they're having a good time and they're doing well.
Would more money have made you happier?
Had we sold, I would have received more money than I did selling to the ESOP. But that was a conscious decision, because I could see that, at some point, enough is enough. And I mean, it's always nice to have more, but I've got enough, thankfully. And another, two or three or whatever, or four, whatever, would not change my life at all. Because I can do anything I want to do, anything that I'm going to want to do right now.
That's powerful. Thank you for doing this. Is there anything we haven't talked about or I haven't asked you that you want to cover before we close out?
Just if you're in business, be aware that management has to transition. If you're in business, be aware that ownership has to transition. I used to use the example, ownership will transition if you die in a saddle. So if the horse you're riding is about to fall, it's time to get off. I can't overemphasize that. I told you about this book, Unlocking Private Company Wealth. I talk about management transition and ownership transition. And if I have a message for business owners today, it is that there is nothing more important than taking those concepts seriously and moving with a certain amount of intentionality to allow the second generation or the rest of the management team to have the responsibilities that they need to have to grow, and that ownership gets where it needs to be so that it is not in the way of success.
Well said. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Driven By podcast. If you enjoy the show, please leave a review. Please subscribe to the show, and you can follow me on social, on Twitter and Instagram, to join me for future episodes of the Driven By podcast. Hope you have a great week, and see you next time.